Talking about a soldier of love. A soldier of love. One of my favorite bumper tunes by the very talented Sade. Talking about a soldier of love. And that's really apropos for our program this evening. Oh, did I mention Welcome to another edition of Progressive News Weekly. My name is Daryl Clark, and yes, you are at the right place at the right time here on Progressive News Weekly, week in and week out. We bring you news and information that's gathered from around the world, primarily within the continental United States, though occasionally we do go overseas. We have listeners from coast to coast, north, south, east, and west, and again, occasionally throughout the Caribbean and overseas. The news typically comes from you, so I like to say it's news for you, by you, and of you. When I say from you, it's listeners like yourselves that bring the real news, real topics, and suggestions for guests. So I encourage you to continue that. Send me an email to Daryl, D-A-R-R-Y-L, underscore C-L-A-1-8 at MSN.com. And let me know of topics and or guests that, well, aren't getting the attention that they so deserve, that the masses should be hearing about or hearing from in the case of guests. And we'll do our best to vet, of course, we always vet to make sure that the information is valid and attempt to make it happen. This is a venue that we must utilize. It's international in scope. And most radio, listen up, most radio is considered conservative. When I say conservative as opposed to liberal, conservative in political terms, also considered right. And I don't like using those terms, but to give you an example, Rush Limbaugh, if you don't know who that is, look it up. I don't want to take time to educate you on that, would be considered very conservative, extreme conservative. And so most radio, 80% plus, is that. And so you have a venue in Progressive News Weekly. I can't encourage you enough to use it. So a shout out to all the folks that do tune in week in and week out and share Progressive News Weekly. We appreciate it. We need it. The masses appreciate it and need it, whether they even know it or not. So I just encourage you to continue to spread the news. This is a country that was founded on the principles of being for the people, by the people, and of the people. But so often, and especially recently, we can question that. And that's putting it lightly. And that's going to be part of our topic for today, that we're not really getting news and information that can be considered real. And as an example, you can go into a department store at any given time and you'll see set up mannequins and displays, and sometimes you'll have perhaps fruit on a table if it's a furniture store depicting a dining room and the fruit is plastic. Well, some of the information that we're getting at its worst can be considered plastic, and we have to be vigilant in speaking out on that. We have a scheduled guest today, speaking of being vigilant on speaking out with the truth, who is renowned for just that. We're hoping that she will be able to join us, because in relatively short notice, we were just having a conversation earlier in the week, and we were thinking next week, and she was pretty much enthused about making it happen this week. And so, you know, I questioned it, and I said, are you sure? Because I know her schedule is so very busy. And she said, well, yeah. So if we're not able to reach our scheduled guest, and purposely I'm not mentioning the name, because I want you to get on our mail list. I want you to send me an email and forward it Daryl_CLA18@MSN.com. So I'm going to just play a little bit of bumper tune while we reach out to Dr. Joy DeGruy. Hello? So much for a bumper tune. Let's try that one more time. And on the other side of this bumper tune, well, we're going to come back with Dr. Joy DeGruy. And we apologize for that little bit of a delay. Though we did have a little bit of a technical situation, we're going to come right back with a real soldier of love. Let me just put that out there. So we're going to take about a 15-second hiatus, and we're going to come back with Dr. Joy DeGruy. As I've told you before, hold on to your seats because Joy DeGruy hasn't been with us in almost a year, and she is raring and ready to go. So on the other side of this, Dr. Joy DeGruy. Yes, a soldier of love. How apropos for our guest this evening. One of my favorite bumper tunes that I have in the quiver. And so, as I said, so apropos. As I know many of you have been waiting for, without further ado, we have as our special guest this evening, Dr. Joy DeGruy, author of the renowned Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. I can go on and on talking about Dr. Joy DeGruy. Google this lady. Her body of work speaks for itself, is all I can say about Dr. Joy DeGruy. She's truly a social scientist, a humanitarian. She's spoken nationally and internationally, Harvard, Columbia, Oxford. I can go on and on, television, radio, the bottom line is she spent over 20 years walking the talk. And her nationally acclaimed book, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing, it just depicts what has occurred to bring us to where we are today, which is why I'm just honored and thrilled to have my friend and someone I highly respect be able to join us. It's times like these that it really makes my gratuitous work here on this radio station all well worth it. And today, we're going to talk about some of the egregious acts that have taken place, how we got here, and maybe just a little bit about what we might do to get ourselves out of this, because we're truly in a sinking ship. But all is not lost. We can raise it, but it's going to take a collective effort and some work. So with that said, I bring you Dr. Joy DeGruy. Dr. DeGruy, welcome to another edition of Progressive News Weekly. It's been a while.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It has been a while, but, you know, we've both been busy clearly doing the work.
Oh, yeah.
I've thought about you through it, and I've seen, you know, I've been able to follow some of the work you're doing and some of the other individuals you've had on. And, you know, it's just, as you know, this is a really crazy time. So, you know, all hands on deck.
All hands on deck. I was out at a rally yesterday. It's interesting you say that. And that was one of the things. I had a moment to speak. We were in support of the Million Man March coming up, and we're doing a local Million People's March in Newark in July.
Oh, nice, nice, nice.
So I'll make sure you get the information. But, yeah, we just kicked that off last week. And so we're traveling all over state and just trying to get that built up. Of course, I'll send you the information. We'll be talking about it in the weeks ahead. And, yeah, I just made a statement that the ship is sinking, but we can raise it. It's going to take a collective effort. We're at a crisis, folks. Let's get real. And two things I mentioned, and I'm going to segue to you on that. I said we got to be aware of the not my problem syndrome and the crabs in the barrel syndrome. You know, that I think I'm going to bring my brother or sister down because that'll make me look a little bit. That we don't have time for that Willie Lynch stuff. So with that said, so much has happened. Dr. DeGruy, I just want to hand the microphone over and just let you just give us some good, you know, mental nourishment. As you said, we've had, you know, many guests and speakers, but none more versed than yourself, and we've been just starving to hear your perspective about this. The lines are packed. With that said, we are going to give you an opportunity to comment or ask a question of Dr. DeGruy. If you're interested in that, you will dial 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142. If you haven't already dialed that, you will. And if you have, you'll just press 1, and myself or actually our engineer Cecil will pick up and give you an opportunity to comment. So with that said, Dr. DeGruy, just at 100,000 foot, if we can, yeah, we've got a 45 minute or so window here. So take your time, and you know how we do it here. If we run out of time, the next time you're available, we're gonna pick it up. This isn't mainstream media where you get 5 or 10 minutes and then you're left with your tongue hanging like, wow, they just got started. You know how we do it. So take your time. What in the world? In the lab, I could go on, Freddie Gray. I could, you know, come on, Michael Brown. In my hometown, you know, Cleveland, Ohio. In fact, today, I was just listening to some 223 days later and still nothing going on. They want to investigate. Now they want to have a reenactment of the incident. It's videoed all over the place. Why you want to enact it? This has gone overboard. They have pushed the envelope. It's just ripped up. Happening.
I think, you know, first of all, this is not, you know, this is something when you and I talked, you know, ways back, you know, we were talking about that this is a distinct possibility of what would happen if we kept on the same trajectory that we were on then. So we are seeing the results of one, inaction, and one, you know, ignoring what was right in front of us. You know, first of all, the violence is not new. right? It's not new. The violence has been here and consistently has been within our communities from the moment we arrived here. This is not a new phenomenon. What is new is that it's on international blast because of the media and because of the fact that folks have caught these things on video is the reason why all of a sudden we've become more aware of it. But this is going on all the time. The murdering and the killing of black males, who I believe have a huge bullseye on them, have for a long time. But I think that we are in a particularly difficult spot now because of the level of fear. There's a great deal of fear. Fear is what really causes this stuff to combust. It's the fear. For example, I think it was years ago. You know, I was talking about this whole idea of what the world is made up. And the majority of the world is a world of color. That's a fact. That's not my opinion. That's a reality. Just simply counting numbers, the majority of the people of the world are people of color. So we're also seeing this kind of not just anti-black people, but anti-people of color, period. Anti-immigration, anti-anything. And you have to start asking yourself the fundamental question, what is the fear that is perpetuating these kinds of behaviors, this kind of hatred, right? And what you're looking at is a changing world, a world that is changing very naturally, changing hands, changing color. And that creates a certain dynamic of fear that ends up spurning into what we see right now. Now, not long ago, last year, and this is where, you know, you and I have to kind of see some of the more contemporary things that I folded into my presentation. And one of them, in Portland, Oregon, in front of a particular organization, the organization is called IRCO, I-R-C-O, and it's a refugee program for folks coming in and helping them get settled and this sort of thing. And in April of 2014, a group of people, all white citizens, stood outside with a huge banner, stood in front of this organization with a huge banner. You can actually Google this. And it says, diversity equals, an equal sign, white genocide. Okay, so, and this is huge. This is huge across the country. Are you with me?
Wow. I'm riveted.
This is huge. Yeah. This is huge. And this is something, you can Google that. Diversity equals white genocide. Now, the paranoia in that statement, let's just stay right there. That means if this, then that, which also perpetuates this notion of us against them. In other words, if we don't stand for ourselves, it means our annihilation. And that's a really crazy notion, 2015. You know, it's just a crazy notion. So now I want you to remember that. That was 2014, showed up. Again, I'm not talking about something a long time ago. I'm talking about April. Right. So we're looking at behaviors that are ratcheted in. A friend of mine, his name is Randy Blazek. You can also look up Randy. Randy is a sociologist, sociology professor at Portland State University. Randy is usually the person that people call when there are mass shootings, particularly gang involved stuff, because at one point or another he infiltrated the skinheads. Matter of fact, you can see his published works around what he learned about skinheads. Now, this was back, I want to say, 90s that Randy did that. You know, and he infiltrated the skinheads in Florida. And what he published after that, he talked about classic strain syndrome, but more importantly, he talked about the whole idea that you, at that particular time, white males were suddenly realizing that they were not able to purchase, for example, homes in the neighborhoods where their own families had purchased homes, their parents. In other words, they weren't going to do as well as their parents did. And at that point, they felt like they had been robbed of their natural birthright, which is an unearned privilege. So they were saying, my gosh, why don't I have my birthright? This is my country. It belongs to me. I'm supposed to run it. Not only am I supposed to run it, have it, I'm supposed to enjoy all the fruit. And I'm also supposed to have access to, and you just fill in the blank. So this was the perception back in the 90s. And you have to know that since the election of President Barack Obama, that the actual Klan, you have to look at the Southern Poverty Law Center, that these specifically racially based hate groups have quadrupled. Now, mind you, our focus and our attention has been on, oh, the Latino gangs, the African-American gangs, the Bloods and the Crips, but no one's really spoken about one of the most horrific gangs in American history, right? And so we've watched that. Now, this is something back in the 90s. I'm having this conversation with Randy Blazak about, you know, he said, we need to be concerned because this level of angst around me losing my birthright as a white male, and that is to rule and control and to enjoy all the spoils, that notion, unearned, it's just that I'm white and I'm supposed to have that, has really digressed into this horrible fear. Now, let's fast forward that to the recent killings that occurred in the church and what the statement was that was made. Again, it's just another, it's that concept on steroids. It's no. Now you're raping our women. You are trying to take over what is rightfully ours. Now, mind you, when you start talking about immigrants, everybody here is an immigrant if you're not native, right? So the bottom line here, though, is that it's now, again, it's growing in a fever pitch because the economy, economically, I'm supposed to have these material goods that I'm not able to access. Well, whose fault is it? You have to find who's the scapegoat. Well, it's all of these, you know, these people of color. Now, again, when you start looking at the numbers, you start understanding the paranoia and the fear. Now, you included in that, and here's the issue within America, as you start talking about remedy. How do we remedy this? We have to understand that it's so intrinsic in every major institution in America. These notions of what we call white supremacy or white privilege or whatever word you want to use, this is deeply ingrained and embedded in every major institution in America. So it's like asking the person that shot you to actually arrest themselves, okay? You're asking the very system that has produced this differential treatment to somehow treat you differently. And so the change that has to occur, the level of remedy, is twofold. And one of them is, you know, my work, which says, well, first of all, heal you, okay? Doesn't matter what anybody else is doing. We need to get clear about who we are. We need to be clear and healthy as individuals, as families, as communities. And we have to make certain that this notion of racial and social justice doesn't become just intellectual fodder. It's real. And without it, we're talking about the undoing of this country. We're talking about its undoing. And we're looking at it on one level, but I think we need to look at it at a broader level, that if we continue this behavior, you're going to see the undoing of America. The very fundamental premise of this country, which, you know, rests upon the notion of freedom and democracy. It's not, you know, this is not a delusion. This is right in front of us. And you have to also understand the broader implication, and that is America's enemies are watching. And so this is something that warrants whatever anybody's particular opinion or perspective is, it warrants a level of attention that it's not getting. And so for me, you know, as I've watched it, you know, and done whatever I could in terms of the lane that I'm in, this is going to require a much broader attempt at healing than any social scientist or mental health, or it's going to require every ounce of everything we have to turn this around. Now, the good news, here's the good news. The good news is that I think that the children and the youth and the rest of the world is tired of this, and they're wanting to move forward. There's this genuine desire. The issue is no one knows how, especially when you have, you know, us, we're all impacted by the institutions that keep all of this going. You know, and so this is something that we have to do on an individual level. We have to do it on a family level, on a community level, a societal level, and then eventually on a global level. That's how this has to be approached. This is not a small problem, nor is it new. It's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old, embedded in the systems, the very systems that proclaim, you know, this idea of freedom.
Wow.
I mean, you know, it's for me. There's another piece that steps out that kind of looks really clear to me, and I know what is, and it is. It's the truth of the matter is, I believe that our immediate future is pretty grim. I really believe that. I think we're going to see a lot more of the insanity that we're seeing because there's so much fear and there's so much ignorance and there's also so much feeding the fear and the ignorance. So so long as you have that, those things in operation, you're going to see a lot more. I think we have to get smart so we can learn how to be safe and so we can learn how to move forward. So there's two pieces I wanted to share, and if I get a chance on this particular interview, I wanted to talk about, one, the whole idea of paradigm shifts. I want to talk about this notion of change, which is, to me, gives us a great deal of hope. Then I also want to talk about environment, and I want to talk about epigenetics. I want to talk about the fact that, you know, we are impacted by all of those generations that came before us. And, you know, you and I have had that conversation. And if you look at Native culture, African culture, you know, ingrained in everything we do is this connection with the ancestors, our connection with those that came before us, those upon whose shoulders we stand. We talk about that. And we've talked about it from a purely, a cultural, spiritual vantage point. But now the sciences are saying that that memories can be embedded for several generations, and memories can be passed along through generations of people. And particularly if there has been trauma, those things get transmitted because, again, it becomes part of the survival of the generation to come. So the news about epigenetics, and we kind of talk a little bit about it for people who don't know. It's not new. I mean, people have been looking at epigenetics. Usually the sciences have looked at it with animals. More recently, they're publishing research around the impact on humans. For example, they took a rat, and what they did was they conditioned this rat to have an aversion for peppermint. I believe the smell that they conditioned it was peppermint. And what they did was, of course, they probably did stuff like horrible stuff to the rat, shocked it or whatever, whenever it smelled. So it developed an aversion. Well, they then later tested the babies of this particular rat. And the babies were born with an aversion to peppermint, having never been exposed to it. So then they tested the grandbabies of the rat and discovered that the grandbabies of the rat were born with an aversion to peppermint, something they had never been exposed to. So then I started to kind of take a look at epigenetics as it relates to humans, and particularly, you know, biological changes. So they were looking at, I think it was the Quebec snowstorm, and they were looking at differences, biological inflammatory responses in children born post the snowstorm. So they're saying, now, if we're looking at something like a snowstorm being able to change the genetic structure, biology of children post that, then what has several hundred years of trauma produced in people of African descent? And so, again, the news is that human beings, we're all humans, but we also pass along, again, the memories. We pass along that genetic information. So with epigenetics, if it can go one direction, it can also go in the other direction. So we can move it beyond trauma and injury to one of resilience and growth and change. That's possible. But here's the problem. In order for me to heal and change the trajectory, you gotta stop hitting me, okay? In order for me to be able to heal, to move our children and the generations that proceed from us into a positive direction. Some of us have already seen those changes. For example, you know, I know my parents gave me all that they could. They did the best they could with what they knew. And I took my children further. And they're going to take their children. I'm seeing the evidence of some of those injuries within my own family no longer being transmitted. And as we heal, we thus heal the generations that are going to come from us, not just in terms of our social learning, not just in terms of what we vicariously learn or we model, but literally what we pass along in our genes. So with that said, we've got to change the direction in which we, our children and our communities are moving. Do you see, it's not, it's no longer nice or politically correct, or it is absolutely essential, or if we do not, we doom the generations that are to come from us. We doom them from our own, as a result of our own injuries that we pass along, whether that is socially passed along or whether it's, you know, we find it locked away in the DNA. Because what we know about, for example, stress, we know that stress is transmitted from a mother in utero to her infant through the umbilical cord, the stress hormone cortisol. So then you have a child born with excessive levels of cortisol. And then if that child is in a stressful environment, if you're black, you probably are. Do you see what I'm saying? So we've got to heal. We must. Now, that being said, that's one piece of it. We have to do this. We don't have an option here, in my opinion. We've got to, or we doom ourselves and we doom the future generation. Now let's take a look at a broader perspective. When I first started taking a look at how this moves from, how this, I was more interested in change. And for the last couple of years, I've been really focusing on how change happens on a lot of different levels, on the level of the individual, the person, on the level of the family, on the level and dynamic of the community, and indeed the world. But let's take a look at how change has occurred as it relates to what the sciences have told us. So there's a book, and the book, is, I don't even know if they read them. They have to read it anymore, but in my educational process, it was a mandatory book, and it was called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. And, I mean, it's pretty, you know, dry reading, and we've certainly advanced beyond that at this point on some level. But there's one thing that I've learned about how change happens. And, for example, I was mentioning to a group I was speaking to at a university a couple days ago. I said, you know, I remember a time, I'm 57, I'll be 58 this year. I remember a time when, I said, the room we're in would be full of ashtrays. And everybody laughed, and a number of people with gray hair kind of shook their head and said, oh, yeah, I remember that. I said, in every meeting, there'd be ashtrays, right? I said, in fact, I grew up where I would visit my family, and on special, you know, special occasions, they put out the nice ashtrays, you know, the ones that have the little stand and little marble connected to them. And people were quite proud of their ashtrays. I asked my grandchildren, I said something about an ashtray, and they said, what's an ashtray? Right, and so the audience laughs. I said, because for my grandchildren, they're like, an ashtray? What is it, and why would you have one? Right, that's their vantage point. And then I said to the group, I said, if someone lit up a cigarette in this meeting right now, if someone lit up a cigarette, and this is a huge, you know, I'm lecturing in the educational, you know, kind of arena. I said, I think the peer pressure alone would put that cigarette out. I said, we start diagnosing the person, wondering if they had mental health problems. I said, because there has been a preponderance of evidence. Stay with me, a preponderance of evidence. Whereas the tobacco industry for years used to write on the, you know, side of the tobacco. I remember I used to buy cigarettes for family members when I was a kid for 50 cents. And they'd say, well, you know, cigarette smoking may, you know, kind of, sort of, possibly have some harmful effects, right? Then if you look at, you know, the Surgeon General warning now, it's like, you know, warning, you will die. So we've gone from this kind of neglect on one level to what we call a preponderance of evidence. And when there is a preponderance of evidence, in other words, when the tobacco industry could no longer snow everybody or create the seed of doubt, then there is a paradigm shift and we never return. We're never going to return to, well, do you think tobacco has a direct impact on health? Nobody's going to ask that anymore because there's been a preponderance of evidence. Similarly, we believed at one point the earth was flat. We believed that, you know, the earth was the center of the universe. And a couple of folks kind of rose and stood up and said, well, I don't think so. You know, and when they did, folks like Galileo and others, you know, they would beat them or kill them. Bono, who was an individual who literally, this man literally had a dream that the universe was expansive. And he described what his dream had shown him, and they burned him alive. So there then was people all over the world started popping up, and there was a preponderance of evidence. We had a paradigm shift, never to return. So no one's going to I want to look back at that notion the earth is flat. No, nobody's going there because there's a preponderance of evidence. Well, now let's take a look at the issue of race, racism, oppression, the whole idea of these, you know, these horrible, horrific hate crimes, all of these things. Well, you see now, this is an absolute truth. We're looking at a preponderance of evidence. Now, remember, whenever you have a preponderance of evidence, there's going to be a paradigm shift. And we're sitting on the precipice. This is my belief. We're on the precipice. Because, you see, we're going to go out kicking and screaming. It's always dark. It's before the dawn. It always gets really, really crazy just before that paradigm shift. And what is happening in the world, this is what I really believe, is that it's going to get far worse because we're getting ready to have that shift. And when that shift occurs, we're never going to return to where we are. Now, as that relates to America, as it relates to how bad it'll get before folks give up the reins of racism and the paternalistic, all of the things we know, what is it going to take to hand over the banner to someone else, to realize that the world is a really big place and you're not the center of it? Oh, my goodness. It's going to get really, really ugly. But the good news is that we're sitting on the edge of a paradigm shift. Because you see, for the first time in the world, you know, the whole world was seeing this. It used to be, you know, you'd hear something nationally that happened. You'd find out months before or months after. And but now people are seeing it in living color across the world. And they're weighing in on it. So we can't hide anymore. And so you can't unknow something, right? So the good news is it's happening. The rest of the world is looking on and shaking their heads and saying, this is not okay. Not just nationally. We're not just hearing about what happened in Charleston or what happened in Florida or what happened. The whole world is seeing what happened. And so as that occurs, you're seeing, again, the momentum build for the shift. But, like again, it's people going to go out kicking and screaming. It's going to get real ugly. It's going to get really, really ugly. And I think that we do a disservice to ourselves and to our children by pretending that this stuff is just going to, all of a sudden we're going to have some, a discussion and it's going to change. We're way beyond that. We've always had options to do that through an act of collective will to change. But we're way beyond that now. We've decided this is going to be ugly. We're going to go out on this one in a very, very violent way. And so from my vantage point, what you and I have to do, the work you do, the work I do, the work any of us, whatever lane you're in or they're in or that's out there, is we've got to step into the gap and we've got to do what we can to lessen the severity of this storm. And we do that by telling the truth. We do that by showing up where we need to show up and helping folks that can't help themselves.
Wow. Let me open the lines up. We've been listening to and having dialogue with Dr. Joy DeGruy, social scientist, humanitarian, author, professor, and I'm going to open the lines up. And so if you have a comment or a question, this would be a good time to let it be known. We have a caller. Is this out of New York? Let me see who we have here. Caller 347, you are live on Progressive News. Who do we have?
Ronald.
Ronald. Oh, Ronald. Ronald Crenshaw. Out of New York?
Yes, out of New York. Ronald Crenshaw.
Yes. One of our previous guests, boy, you don't miss words. So, what wisdom nuggets do you have to share with us today, Ronald?
And well,
say hello
I
to
think the
crew.
Hello, how are you, Dr. Drew? I think you're right on the money with your analysis there. Very much. I can only. Lynn, into what you're saying, I think it's very correct. I think it's connected. This whole situation, the way it's getting, is connected with, as I've always said, the political economy. In other words, capitalism is going into dire straits. So the pumping up of racial antagonism is to take them off of the point of trying to understand the economics of what's happening, you see. So
right.
That's where I go to the political economy, because capitalism itself, the profit system, is very irrational. It's irrational in of itself. So people are being divided more by that, because everyone is trying to get all they can to maintain their positions in the world, when that kind of struggle doesn't have to be maintained if you understand plenty for all. So but that's not what capitalism purports. It's like I have to have it all, you know, because I can never have enough.
Mm.
And that attitude
right.
in of itself makes the question of antagonism between groups more, you know, what should I say, savage. That's the word I want to use.
Well, Ron,
see?
Let me
Absolutely.
Intervene here for a moment, and I want Dr. DeGruy to respond, Ron, to what you're saying, because I'm hearing you say that as much as blacks are affected, let's not forget the big picture, because it really comes down to capitalism and money, and we just perhaps may be at the bottom of the totem pole, and we're in a shark frenzy. Dr. DeGruy,
right.
perspective on this,
yeah.
and stay with us. I just want to hear what Dr. DeGruy has to say on that.
Sure.
I'm just so happy to hear you make that statement, that assessment, which is, I mean, it's huge. The materialism which has driven everything, including slavery itself, you know, that whole idea, and it's insatiable. The part that is so striking about this is there's never enough. People are not satiated. It's like, you know, I was saying to a group of people, I did this with my kids, actually, you know, because my kids were like, when they were younger, I told them, I said, you don't need anything else, period. And of course, they went into fear. My God, what do you mean? I said, you realize you already have more than you deserve. Right? This is what I'm telling my own kids. And again, because in their mind, they couldn't think of having more. In other words, I said, how many people can think in the world of working harder and making less? Maybe only taking one bath, you know, a day or a week. I said, see, it's not imaginable. Everyone I know, you want a bigger one. Someone saw my car, right? I have a Camry. And they were like, I can't believe you drive a Camry. I said, why can't you believe I drive a Camry? Matter of fact, I'm going to drive it until the wheels fall off of it. Right? I'm safe or in perfect condition. But the notion was you need to have a bigger one. You need to have a better one, a shinier one, more of them. You know, all of these things, it's insatiable. And at the same time, you know, when I show my kids a pie chart, I said, here's a pie chart. Here is the United States. This is the percentage of the world that the United States is. I said, now, how much do you think of the world's resources this little sliver here uses up? And when I began to share with them
as much
as 40, and in some cases 70% of the world's resources, so of course being children, they had an idea. They knew what to do. They said, oh, I know, we'll just make certain everybody else has as much as we have. I said, well, no. If everyone else had as much as we have, every natural resource would be gone within a day. I said, because we are in such excess, I said, we can't even imagine what the balance is. We don't even know the balance. And that's why I think it's going to have to be America's going to have to be shaken so severely, because we don't understand. We have no clue about what that means, what the balance is in terms of how we live our lives in the material the materialism that we enjoy here in this country. It's excessive. And we have no – I said, there are people right now, you know, I have a garden. I try to have a garden every year. I like to grow something out the ground. You know, I've taught my children that. I said, you have to understand, food doesn't come from a little package. This is, you know, food comes from somewhere else. I said, because at this point, if the local Safeway closes down, people are going to lose their mind. You know, that there's this total disconnect about how the rest of the world lives. right? And I think that that's a real problem, and it's one that's growing because our children are growing. We're growing in a world where this is amazing to me. You know, people make play dates. Now, I don't have time to go through a great deal about one of the theories that I've used to develop a model, which is working right now. But the whole idea that you have to, I said, well, wait a minute. They said, well, you know, we create play dates because, you know, we have pedophiles out there, and we can't have the children just go play. I said, I'm pretty sure they probably had pedophiles when I was growing up, and they had all the little crazy people. I said, but what we had was a neighborhood. I said, you couldn't sneak up on anybody in my neighborhood. You couldn't snatch up anybody's children that's not in my neighborhood because everybody knew everybody. And it was a poor neighborhood, but we didn't know we were poor. And everybody knew everybody, and it was diverse. We had all kinds of people in my community on my block that would watch you. And my daddy would say, you know, bad news will beat you home. I said, because we had community. And the answer is community. And at the same time, we have something, and I want anybody who's listening to look up an article. It's called Serial Displacement by Fuller Love. Serial Displacement. And there was also a gentleman that was on NPR, Rothstein, who did a thing on government-sponsored and government-sanctioned segregation. There's a reason why we didn't get the GI Bill. Okay, and so what we have to understand is that as we have created serial displacement of people of color, we have seen the absolute disintegration of the fundamental foundation upon which even poor people can survive, and that's a sense of connection. And now people are being pushed out. What is the ultimate response of serial displacement? Continually perpetually displacing people through things called, urban renewal, let's see, curing urban blight, the new one, gentrification, all the same results. Yeah. Violence is a result, and disconnection and disintegration. So the very basic fundamental things that I had to teach my grandchildren and my children is what we have, the most precious resource we have is each other. That's the resource, and we're losing our sense of that.
Tell us about the influence of our media or the information or misinformation that we're being bombarded with. What's your perspective on that? I'll give you an example. I realized that when that person, if I can be so nice, that murdered those 9 loving individuals in that church in South Carolina. I'm trying to really catch myself before I get too emotionally involved at the last week. When I think back on that, just because of the circles and the sites that I go to for my source of information, I realized that there were other churches, and that was one of the first things that crossed my mind. The first thing that crossed my mind was not this target of a being that had done this thing. It was, where did it come from? What's the source? Well, holistically thinking, as I try to do on a daily and moment-by-moment basis, it's not the symptom. I began to think, okay, as you said earlier, Dr. DeGruy, this is not in and of itself the catch-all. This is just a tip.
No.
And you can believe it, we can find Hussein in a hole somewhere, we know where the bulk of that iceberg is. And so I began to just do some just general introspection and realize that there were other churches that were burning within days. Now, that didn't hit the media until the last few days. Now, let me stop and back off and get to my question again. If you would, share with us your thought on that information or misinformation that's going on.
Well, the media, we have to understand the very same thing. Who controls the media? I mean, you know, again, you can't look to the folks, you know, that the first thing that hit me was all of the folks who were running for office, whether it was local or whether it was national office, they started trying to divest themselves of the funds that they were receiving from the Klan, okay, from white supremacist groups.
Yes.
All of a sudden, folks started going, they said, oh, my goodness, oh my goodness, the light is on. Let me just refuse this funding. So what does that say to you? That says to you that before, they were very happy to receive it. And so when you start looking at media, again, you're dealing with the same thing. I have an article, and of course most people know about it. Oda Benga was a Congolese gentleman that was placed in the monkey cage of the Bronx Zoo in 1906.
He was
placed in the monkey cage. Now, you remember that. And thousands of people visited him, this black man placed in a monkey cage. Now, what I want you to pay attention to was not only was that allowed to happen, and white people felt fully, you know, satisfied walking through and seeing this black man placed in a cage with monkeys, when the African-American community arose and other right-minded, sane individuals saying, this is not okay, it's immoral and all the other things, guess who defended it? The New York Times. Go online and read what they had to say about Oda Benga being placed in the monkey cage. They basically said he needed to be there because he was so low in his development. In other words, he was subhuman to them. And they said there's no reason why we should think he should be in a school rather than a cage. This is the New York Times, okay? And so what we have to appreciate is when you start peeling back the layers, you're going to see the same people and the same kinds of people that have invested in these systems. So if we're expecting these systems to turn on themselves, that's not likely going to happen. Hence the whole power of this whole cyber age. Do you see what has freed people is they're not looking for NBC or ABC's or CNN's report or the New York Times. They videotape it with their phone. Do you see what I'm saying? They bypass those huge bastions of information that control and also distort where necessary. Are you following me? So what's happening is, and this is, they said God don't like ugly. You know what I mean? And the bottom line is what has emerged, truth will emerge. The truth will emerge, you know. And I really do believe fundamentally that is what we're looking at. I believe, and you know I've talked about it for years, truthfulness is a foundation of all human virtue. It is the secrets that make us sick. It is the lies that keep us sick.
Tell the truth.
We can't get anywhere without that.
That's true. That's very true.
Oh my gosh! If we just dealt with that alone, Dr. DeGruy, I mean, if we thought about how many of the problems that we're dealing with today across the board, from health, I mean, just issues to just immorality, just that were grounded and founded in lies. I think if we could eradicate that, we might be where we want to, at least significantly on our way. If you just think about it.
If people had real information from which, you know, they can make informed decisions. I talked about years ago when I first started out, you know, on your show, doing all this stuff. You know, I said our children don't know who they are. You can't fix what you don't understand. You can't change what you don't know. You've got to know it and then change it. And the bottom line is there is a disincentive in educating people. There's a disincentive because this has been controlled, and as was said earlier, you know, this whole system, the whole economics of America is based upon, the whole capitalist system is based upon maintaining a stranglehold over people and controlling everything in their lives, even what they think, and that includes media and everything else. You have to maintain your position.
Certainly does. That's right.
Dr. DeGruy, we're going to be upset, even though some folks will not get to comment, but I'm hoping we can expect, you know, not in the not-too-distant future for you to come back and continue, because we only have about 10 or 15 minutes, but I do want to get to some of the listeners. We have a listener, looks like New Jersey, 908, and then we have a 732 coming up. So 908-756, who are we talking with?
Hi, it's Deborah Dow from Plainfield.
Oh, Deborah, and, oh, a homegirl. All right. So, Deborah, what comment or question do you have of Dr. DeGruy? Hello to Dr. DeGruy.
Well, I've come up with some talking points through the years, and one of them is I tell everybody that even if the white man is the problem, the white man is not the solution. And
that's
I
right.
tell this to white and black people who all seem mystified by that concept. But, you know, and then the other thing, you know, I think about is that to a large degree, being black is performance art. And we do wear a mask and we self-censor and we play a role. And we are not real in our cross-racial relationships, and we don't hold white people accountable even when they're our so-called friends. And everybody has to have more courage and talk to their white people. White people need to talk to your relatives, your racist cousin at the barbecue, and we who have white friends need to toughen them up and turn them loose on the rest of the white people. And we have failed to do that on an individual,
right.
non-political level in our relationships.
Right.
We have to be more honest.
That's right. That's right.
True.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you,
Dr. DeGruy. What do you have to say about that,
Dr.
DeGruy? Thank you, Deb, for that comment. Thank you for listening.
She's renewed my hope in humanity.
Well, you inspired me to call. I rarely come up and say anything, but I really appreciate what you said today. And, you know, I look forward to hearing more from you.
So do
Hey, back at you. I feel so good about that. Because, again, what you said is absolutely true. Let me give you a perfect example of that. I mentioned this at a university that I was speaking at recently. So there's been some recent research that's shown that a teacher, a white teacher, in a classroom with, and let's say that the students, two students are off task. Let's say that the two students that are off task are doing the same off task behavior. If one of those children is a black child and the other child is a white child, the teacher will not see the white child off task. She will see the black child off task or the Latino child off task, or whatever child is not white. And I'm going to bring this all the way up to something that happened to me a couple days ago. But, okay, so now I understand this. This is the data. This is what the data said. You know, over and over again, we've seen this behavior. We've seen black children, you know, getting referrals at a much higher level. But they're watching the same level of children being off task. So now my question then becomes, and I say this to the teachers that were in the room I was talking to, I as a grandparent should not I walk into the classroom with a white teacher and say, "Hello, Miss Jones, so glad you're here. I need to know what you're doing to mediate your bias as it relates to discipline and as it relates to giving instruction, corrective information to my black grandchild son here. I need to know what you're doing to mediate that, your bias." Now, her response might be, or his response may be, "Well, I'm not a racist." And my response to that is, I don't care what you think about it. This song isn't about you. What this song is about is safeguarding him. And I have evidence to suggest that you may not be aware of your bias. Thus, it's informing the question again, what are you doing? You see, that's accountability. If we know it, and what we do is we know this stuff. We have all the data, all the research, all the statistics, and then we send our children in there and just hope for the best. I hope nothing goes wrong. Really, you should be able to walk into, which, of course, let me say I'm saying that because that's precisely what I did. Okay, that is precisely what I did. I walked in and said, "I need to know what you're going to do to safeguard him because of your conscious or unconscious tendency to weigh him in a negative way." So those are things that, and so I'm saying it to these teachers, and, you know, most of whom are white, and at the same time I'm going, you know, no, we know this stuff. And then we send them into institutions and expect them to get what's just and fair. That's foolish. Now, the teacher may be a really good person, has nothing to do with whether or not they, you know, they have a Confederate flag in the basement. I don't know. That's not what I'm saying. My point is there's a preponderance of evidence that suggests that this is what shows up and this is what goes on, even though you think you're a good person, even though, you know, you don't consider yourself a racist. My daughter calls this a subtle contempt. It's a subtle contempt that people, white people often have and don't know it. And it shows up, and even a five-year-old can see it. So now, fast forward. I'm minding my business. I think I talked to you about this, Daryl. I'm minding my own business because, you know, when it gets deep, I go fishing. Everybody knows me. It gets deep, I go get in my garden, I go fishing. So I'm getting ready to pick up a few trinkets to go fishing. And I notice that the police are outside in front of the Target. So I'm going, what the heck? So they're approaching an SUV. So I'm looking at a police officer, guns drawn, gun is showing, right? And another police officer coming up the side, guns drawn. So I'm stopping, you know, I'm from South Central. I say, oh, no, there may be exchange of gunfire. So I stop where I am, you know, and behind this huge, you know, pole, the cement block, and I'm behind it watching what's going on. And so I'm taking in, I mentioned to a couple of your children strolling across the street, people hip-hop, they're not even noticing what's going on. So then I noticed they pull out the woman. These are all Latino people. Pull out the Latino woman. They take her, they handcuff her, and they put her in one of the police cars. Now, by now, three more police cars have shown up, so there are four police cars. So now another police officer, one that had the other gun drawn, pulls a Latino man out of the back seat of the car. So they handcuff him, put him in a car. So I said, oh, there must have been a robbery. You know, I'm doing the math on what happened because it's right in front of the Target. Next thing you know, the back of the SUV, they open it up, the trunk, they're pulling out bags that have Target on it. I said, oh, that must be what happened. Now, we're about maybe 30 minutes in. So now I'm walking towards, you know, in front, directly in front of the Target, and I noticed that in the back seat of the car are two children in car seats. Crying. So one child looks to be about maybe five. The other one looks to be about seven. And the little girl, who's about five, her face is red because it's 99 degrees where I am, 99 degrees. And they've been in this car for 30 minutes. Their parents have both been arrested. And they're screaming and crying for their parents. So I stop and I'm going, oh, my God. You know, so I see the lone female police officer who's standing there. And I walk up to her, of course, my hands are showing. I said, excuse me. I said, I have a real concern that these children are experiencing severe trauma right now. And she turns around. It's almost like the lights came on. She goes, like, you could see her embarrassed. Because the whole time this is going on, they are ignoring those two children. And I couldn't help wondering if they'd have ignored those two children, pulled guns out, when there were two blonde-haired Cindy and Timmy in the backseat. I just don't believe it. Now, that could be me. So the woman immediately says, okay, I can't talk to you and talk to them. And she immediately gets the kids out of the car. I said, I'm happy to go get them some water. They've been sitting in a hot car. It's got to be burning up in that car. And she goes, no, I'll make certain they get it. So I see her walking the children away. And I think to myself, they couldn't see the humanity of those children? They couldn't get there. Now, mind you, everybody who says their parents, oh, they are a hot mess. They started stealing in front of their children. They are bad parents, whatever you want to call them. But I looked children, and I looked at the fact that nobody acknowledged their humanity. Nobody. So I'm saying, yeah, I stepped in the gap. And maybe the only positive image of a police officer, because they created criminals, what they did. That's what the police were doing in their behavior. Because this child who's conflicted, yeah, their parents are crazy, but they're also looking at a system that's supposed to protect them. And maybe the only positive image they'll ever have is that police officer taking them and getting them a glass of water. But, again, if we aren't holding people accountable, do you see exactly what the sister said? We've got to hold folks accountable, and we can't be afraid to do that. We can't be afraid to step in the gap. I don't know what else to do. I couldn't go home and look in the mirror if I hadn't done something for those children. You know, and again, where is our humanity? Where is it?
Yeah.
You know, and we have to have courage. We have to have the strength to do this. You know, I'm impassioned about it. I'm emotional about it. I probably always will be. But I don't know any other way to be.
Well, you don't change, and I don't see that happening. And believe me, the moment I do, like I know you'd pull my coattail, I would pull yours, but I don't see that happening. We have another caller or two, and we're going to have to limit them to just a few minutes until the next time when you join us, and we'll put them up front. So we have a 732545. You know who you are, so you're live with Dr. Joy DeGruy. Who do we have here?
You have Stephanie DeGeneste, and I am so excited that I got a chance to call in. Daryl and I know each other very, very well. Dr. DeGruy, you are an inspiration to me. You have been, whether it's post-traumatic slave syndrome, hearing your voice tonight. Don't you ever change. You continue to be impassioned because you are an inspiration to those of us who are foot soldiers in the community trying to do various and sundry things. My question to you, you know, you spoke about serial displacement. You've also talked about how we're losing our humanity. I know I've tried various things to do, but in your estimation, should we start in the neighborhood? Should we do things in our house? Our churches, in many cases, have lost their way. Where can we get the best bang for our buck in recapturing our children's minds and helping them to really be the force that they absolutely have to be moving forward? What would you suggest?
All of the above. I think that, you know, what I've been doing, so I have the professional piece that I do, but then I have the personal piece that I do. And in the personal piece that I do, you know, my family, for example, we have gatherings. We have family gatherings. Sometimes we have to say, okay, it's time to bring everybody together to have that conversation, you know, about a plan B. You know, we have that conversation. I do women's gatherings where, you know, I bring women. We'll do a three-day. I say, look, come bring your pillow. We're going to hang out. We're going to cook food. We're going to do hair. We're going to view film. We're going to sing. We're going to get into intense conversations, you know, to just be with each other, period.
Okay.
3 days. You know, they get there Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and we just hang. And that's something I just actually moved to my present location. Going to do it here. Going to extend that invitation. I already told my husband. I said, okay, now you can stay if you want to. But the house will be full of women. And really, it's about really coming together, just being together, enjoying and fellowshipping together. So my answer is it begins at home. It begins in what you can do, what I can do. It doesn't just end with me and my family, my children, my grandchildren. It's everybody I see in my community. It's within my home. It's within my community. And, again, anyone who reaches out there, I can help. I will. You know, I got to keep the lights on. But at the same time, I feel like all of us, you know, you talked about it, Daryl, earlier, all hands on deck. Everybody needs to get in their lane and show up for this. And it has to happen on those levels, on all those levels. It's not any one. We need them all. You know, and like I said, I do what I can from where I am, but there are other folks that do what they do. I tell people, do what you do. Bring it to the party. And whether or not, you know, I know my daughter is doing it, my sons are doing it, they're trying to help and heal where they are and to help people who don't know what to do. I'll really have to tell you, you know, I can't help it. This is how I teach. But there was a woman that I developed a 10-week graduate-level course for black parents of kids that were in trouble, adjudicated youth. So I wrote this 10-week program, and really what the program was is everything I've learned. Everything I learned, I passed out charts. They was reading books. I had everything I did in my graduate course, I did with these parents, some of whom never even got through high school. Some of them didn't even get through middle school. I said, but this is something you need to know more than anybody else. So I was teaching them, you know, all of these things that I learned, human development, all the stuff that I had taught at the university. Anyway, one day, and let me just tell you who these parents are. Some of these parents have done time. Some of these parents have been shot, stabbed a couple times. Hardcore. These folks didn't just fall off a truck. You can't come. You better come with the real, whatever you come with. So one day, this woman comes into my class. And first of all, she comes in with a whole crew of people that ain't supposed to be there. I mean a whole crew. And I just say to them, well, because I'm not getting ready to tell her they can't be in the room. So they show up because I could barely be supposed to be doing the class. I'm doing all kinds of stuff, making it okay in my MOU to be able to do the class. So anyway, the woman, she comes in and she said, that's my nephew there. That's my niece over here. This is my daughter. She started pointing to all of them. And I said, okay. I said, all right. And so I just start passing out the material to them. And so she raises her hand. I'm starting the class. She raises her hand. She goes, Miss Joy. I said, yeah. She goes, I need to tell you something. I said, okay. She said, we read your whole book last night.
Oh, wow.
We read the whole book. And she brought them all in, right? And I gave them all a book. And she said, no, we read the whole book. I said, okay. I said, all right, thank you. I said, but we only dealing with the first two chapters today. We only dealing with the first two chapters. She goes, no, that's not why I want to tell you that. I said, well, why you want to tell me that? Now, you got to remember, there's a whole class that we have not started because of this whole thing going on. She goes, I just need you to know what your book did for me.
Hmm.
I said, what did the book do for you? She goes, I was going to whoop this woman's ass up in Macy's. And I thought about what you said, and I didn't whoop her ass because I knew I didn't have to do that. It was the biggest compliment ever paid to me, that she was able to translate what she learned into a change of her behavior, and that rippled to her entire family. Do you see what I'm saying? She was the center of that. And for her, that was huge. And
of
for me, it was even bigger. Do you see what I'm saying? What I recognize is how important it was to give it to her, because she immediately gave it to everyone that was around her. Has to happen on all the levels.
That's beautiful. That is beautiful.
That is great.
Stephanie, thank you for calling. Stephanie is one of our prior guests. She is a true community advocate, founder of a local charter school. I mean, just a good person. Stephanie, kudos for you and what you do in the community. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
I have another. I'm going to take one more caller, and then we've got to wrap it up. And Dr. McGrew, I'm going to be on the phone with you right afterwards, because we still got some work to do. I want to get more into selectively what we can do. But we have a 908-757, and this is a number I always see. 908-757, you're live with Dr. Joy DeGruy.
Hi, how are you?
I thought that was a number. Is this...
Hello, from Jersey. How are you?
Hello?
I'm at a question for Dr. DeGruy.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to give a quick question. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Okay. This is a question. You were talking about earlier about white people and their predilection in terms of not being aware of their, you know, perceived or unperceived racism or racist attitude that they may really be unconscious of. But this is a question. I noticed that the predominantly African-American and Latino high school, I think there would be a couple of white teachers who really seem to have rapport with the kids as opposed to some of the other black teachers who don't quite make the mark. So I was wondering what perspective you had on that.
Okay, let me just say this. Some of the most difficult people I have ever had to deal with look like me. let's be clear. And there's nothing worse, in fact, in my experience, there's nothing worse than having that black person that dislikes black people more than white people do. Okay, and again, this is when we get into the work of post-traumatic. And what often happens in institutions, not just schools, but just in general, you will find, and you all will bear me out on this, that the black person that they do hire, all the rest of the black people are looking at going, how did that happen? Why did that happen? Right? And these people sometimes become the most deeply entrenched gatekeepers, the most injurious people around, because they're broken. You see, they're broken people. And sometimes when people get hired, they go, any black will do. You see, because there's no real difference that is made between, so any black will do. And I will say that often to white people, I go, how many of you know black people that aren't black? And they'll look at me curiously. I said, because there's plenty of us black people that know black people that aren't black, that want to be anything but black. I said, and they punish black people because they are black. I said, now those people actually are a greater injury to our children than the white teacher. Because there's an expectation that you're going to treat me differently. You're going to treat me justly and fairly. And when that doesn't show up, it's even more injurious to our children. So that, hence, when I talked about the whole idea that we must heal. Because what we're doing is we have broken people that are trying to help other folks. And all they're passing along is broken material. Right? And again, when the brother talked about, and the sister talked about accountability earlier, I'm talking about holding everybody accountable. I don't care who you are. We need to hold you accountable. And if you're causing injury or disturbance or a problem, we need to get with you. And I don't care who you are, whether you're black, it doesn't matter. Matter of fact, even more so. But we have to, because this is ours to do, right? And again, I have had the biggest fights I've ever had, hardest ones I've ever had. Because we understand how deep-seated post-traumatic slave syndrome is. We know how deep-seated it is when you have someone black that's been beaten down so badly by other black people that all they can think to do is punish black children. And that's something that, again, who's going to make the assessment whether the person you've hired or that's working here has that problem? Well, I can make that assessment because I'm not going to go with any black will do. Right? And so this is something that we have to be, again, accountable for. I know Maynard Jackson made a statement. He said, there's a couple of black folks we got to deal with. He said, we got to deal with the scared black person that becomes a gatekeeper that basically does more harm by, you know, keeping other black folks down. And then you have the incompetent black person that we lose all our credibility because somebody has pumped up or lifted up someone who is clearly incompetent. We can't do either of those things. We've got to hold everybody accountable, and we've got to remove people that aren't competent.
Wow. That is a great note to end on because that's my big hot button. Emma, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for calling in. Emma's an educator.
Thank you.
And I truly appreciate that comment. Dr. DeGruy, as always, amazing, and the time has just flown. Dr. DeGruy, I'm going to put you on the spot. You know, I've done this over the last 7 or 8 years many times, but I'm going to put you on the spot again and say, can I reach out to you after we're off the air and see if we can get this interview extended in your next available opportunity?
Of course. And of course I have to say of course. But, again, I think we need to start doing this. I think we need to have dialogues. We need to have topics. We need to address what's going on. All of what you're doing, I'm so grateful that you're there. So grateful.
Well, truly, my pleasure. You're a motivator for me, and I'm not just saying that to patronize you, as you've heard from many of our listeners. For those of you who could not get through, I don't give idle promises. I do promise you I will reach out to Dr. DeGruy, and she is very busy. But I do have confidence that we'll be able to bring Dr. back, hopefully, in a not too distant future. So, Dr. DeGruy, you are truly a sister of love. For all of you listening out there, tell someone about Progressive News, but more importantly, there's a few things that Dr. DeGruy said, and that is we must tell the truth. That, as I said, as we close, is critical. We need to hold each other accountable. We don't just talk heads here on Progressive News. We always walk away with deliverables. So as we go into our Independence Day weekend,
all these things.
Boy, that's an oxymoron. But as we go into that weekend, make sure that you see someone body, especially those close to you.
That's right.
You know, charity starts at home. So especially those close to you, talk to that one somebody about who they really are. And then your neighbor. Colleague, those in the grocery store, the bank, the post office, and so forth. And let's germinate this.
That's what that should be.
At Dr. DeGruy's. So with that said, also the archives are available immediately after this program. So So as you go and talk about this program you heard, and I know you're going to be excited, let folks know. They need to go out and they need to get Dr. Drew's book. They don't have it. Static slave syndrome. I need to mute that. They need to go out and they need to get the book Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. And Dr. DeGruy, I still refer to it from time to time. And two chapters came to mind, and others appreciate this unless they read it. The one titled Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome and Slavery's Children. Anyway, you can imagine. But we'll talk. But anyway, thank you, Dr. DeGruy. We're going to end out on how we opened up Soldier of Love, because Dr. DeGruy is truly a soldier of love. And those lyrics by Sade, I advise everyone, go and listen to those lyrics, Soldier of Love. Capable, act. We need to know ourselves better so that we know. Dr. DeGruy, we'll be talking real.
All right.
I've lost the use of my heart.